Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, today we will be talking with Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about the power of words in healthcare.
Important topic, Christy. I think you and I and our colleagues in family medicine at the University of North Carolina, we're aware, but you know what? Sometimes we're not aware, and perhaps we need to be more aware of the power of words.
We will be after we have that conversation, but first we have some research that matters.
Yeah, the power of research. And our first one is on food, and we're going to also talk about what other things?
We're going to talk about readmissions to another hospital might threaten patient safety.
About concussion rates in athletes.
And about asthma linked to bone loss.
Well, let's talk about this very first study about food. And I was really surprised by this research, Christy, that about 9% of older Americans don't get enough to eat each day because they have difficulty affording food.
And this lack of sufficient food, which we often refer to as food insecurity, means that people take in fewer calories, and apparently this is more common in seniors, and the people who are more food insecure have higher incidence of diabetes, cholesterol problems, high blood pressure, heart attacks, gum disease, all kinds of different health-related problems, and yet they don't have enough food to eat.
And this was actually research from the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination survey. And really interesting, Christy, because they found out that a lot of these seniors, particularly if they have, let's say, grandchildren in the home, are even more at risk. So they want to make sure that their grandchildren, the children perhaps, are getting food before they are. And perhaps not enough of them are even taking advantage of existing resources like the food stamp program.
And I think this makes us much, I mean, to me, this was shocking to think that 9% of our older Americans don't have enough food in our country, in America, where we have support, and raises awareness and hopefully for you to think about the older people in your life and making sure that they're aware of the resources. And if you've got grandparents in your home, that you're thinking about, hey, are we doing what we need to do to make sure they have enough to eat?
So bottom line, I think we all should be doing something to help alleviate hunger among seniors, among children, with our food banks, with the food stamp programs, with all of our efforts combined. And there is a role for providers and patients to helping do this better than we are.
Sure. Let's talk about readmissions to hospitals. So there's been a lot of focus in our country on trying to reduce readmissions to the hospital, meaning once you've been in the hospital and you leave, to try to prevent coming back. This was a huge study done in Canada looking at people who were released from one hospital and then turned up at a different hospital for readmission in 30 days versus someone who came back to the same hospital.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, Christy. This was research that was in the Canadian Medical Association journal Open. And because I would have thought, well, people in Canada would have, like, if they had to go back in the hospital, they all had to go back to the same hospital. I thought it was kind of like required, you know, kind of a little bias here on me. And I would think, you know, people in the United States might be going in and out of some different hospitals. But it wasn't the case, even in Canada, that of the 200,000 patients who were readmitted to one of 21 hospitals, 20% who were readmitted went to a different hospital than one they had recently left, which is really interesting. I mean, that goes against what I thought would have happened, suggesting that this is a real big problem, even in Canada.
Well, and considering the problems with information exchange, it does sort of make sense to me that people who showed up at a different hospital might not do as well as if you came back to the same hospital. It's a different hospital. You've got a different set of doctors. They don't know maybe what tests have been done at the other hospital. There might be a delay in care because they're redoing tests that were already done. Hard to know what those factors are, but there was a difference.
And, you know, there was some recent research with this large electronic health record systems that we're all adopting, and that when multiple hospitals have the same electronic health record, you can actually reduce unnecessary procedures.
Yep.
Because you can share that information. You can see, oh, this person had a heart catheterization last week at the hospital 20 miles down the road. We don't need to do another one today at our hospital. And so that's the promise of these electronic health records. But I guess there's a lot more to it than just the electronic health record.
I think we'll find that the information exchange and also some continuity of care, meaning you're getting some of going to the same place and getting some of the same teams, will show more and more that we'll get better results. I hope so anyway.
You know, one of the things, Christy, that may be helpful is, you know, we have these electronic health records, but patients really still don't have those easily accessible. A lot of that's still at the doctor level. Perhaps if our patients had their full electronic health record when they go into the emergency room at another hospital, they could share it with their doctors.
Carry it around on your little zip drive or
a credit card or something.
Okay, let's talk about asthma and a link to bone loss.
Well, we've known and concerned that patients with asthma who are a lot of times on chronic long-time steroids to reduce the inflammation in the body, that long-time steroid use could lead to thinning of the bones. But here, the researchers maybe found something linked even without the people on long-term steroid use.
This was published in the Annals of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, a study of more than 7,000 people, including 433 with asthma. And they found that that bone density, or the measure of the thickness and the density of the bones, was independent. It was higher in people who had asthma, even if they hadn't been on long-term steroids.
And they thought it might be related to things like low levels of vitamin D, but I think it raises questions. So I think for us, the take-home is if you do have asthma and you've had it for a long time, talk with your doctor about whether you certainly have other risk factors that might require a bone density study. But it's one more piece in the puzzle, more questions than answers here.
It is. If you do have asthma, it's important to have it treated and continue your treatment and to have the conversation with your doctor. Concussion rates, apparently they're going up according to a U.S. study. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, we're talking about raising more questions than perhaps answers. This was, though, in the American Journal of Sports Medicine. And Christy and I have talked about concussions on Your Health for many years, and we've brought guests here. And we're very sensitive to the fact that this is a big problem in the United States. But the question is, has the concussion rate really dramatically increased? And this research said that it did double between 2005 and 2012, according to a national study that looked at 9 team sports.
This was published in the American Journal of Sports Medicine, appropriately. And I think that this, my bias on this is that this is a very, very important issue and one that we have made progress with in terms of recognition, awareness, and responding to it appropriately or trying to, but that it may be just that we're more aware of it now and we're more likely to make the diagnosis or write the word concussion, whereas before we might have just said, oh, maybe it was a slight concussion, but didn't make that diagnosis.
Or even report it. I can imagine that there are a lot of coaches who may have been reluctant to report it before because they maybe didn't want to pull their athlete out, but now they're like, oh, if I was a coach, I'd be like, I'm gonna report this, you know. And these were girls soccer and boys soccer, boys football, girls volleyball, boys and girls basketball, boys wrestling, baseball, and girls softball. Who would have thought girls softball? But I bet concussions are a frequent aspect of that sport.
I bet they are. And I, you know, as a parent, I want my children, we need our children to be moving and exercising and participating in sports. But the more we talk about concussions, it does make me a little nervous. I feel like maybe I need to just strap on helmets wherever they go.
yes, and for us too, for some of the accidents that we do. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a really good chance to talk about concussion rates and looking at the data, and we're glad that we're reporting it more often.
About asthma linked to bone loss.
About this hospital readmission rates and the need for having good records for the doctor, but also for the patients.
And about 1 in 12 older Americans struggling to afford food.
Well, we'll take a short break, Christy, but when we return, we'll be talking with Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about their research on the power of words in healthcare. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we have the real pleasure of talking with Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about the recent article they published and their research on the power of words in healthcare.
And we just talked about this article a few weeks ago about identifying a set of reliable emotion words. Welcome to the show, both Lauren and Jennifer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you would tell for us and our listeners, both, well, maybe Lauren, you could go first, and then Jennifer, a bit about your passion and how your journey led you to be a part of the study.
Yes. Well, what we wanted to do was really take our improvement work and get a reliable set of emotion words. We use a lot of tools with experience-based design, and what we wanted was a reliable set of emotion words with consistent emotional meaning, so that we would understand when we went over our results, was this positive, neutral, or negative? And that really led me to want to be a part of this study.
Well, Lauren, let me just ask you, though, for a second. How did you kind of get interested in this whole field? Did you wake up one day and said, I'm an emotional person, I want to study emotions? Where did that come from?
Well, I have done all sorts of things here at the Medical Center, and I was so excited to be a part of this research study and kind of lead the way with the participants and the study design and really foster this improvement work.
And how about you, Jennifer? What's your story?
Well, my story is I'm the innovation director here in our Kaizen Promotion Office, and for several years have been involved as we've been studying lean thinking or the Toyota Production System. And a few years ago, we started learning, exporting from actually the National Health Service in the UK, their work around experience-based design. And it just really gelled for us, and it's become a personal passion of mine as well, because we were starting to look at patient experiences and the experiences of family members and actually our staff as well. When they have negative experiences in the framework of lean, we look at that as a defect. So as we started to learn about experience-based design, which is really a set of methods that you can use to pull out the stories, the narratives from people about their emotional experiences, it just really synced with us in terms of where we were as an organization. And I think all of us who have been involved in this here, and I'm sure you and all of your listeners can also identify with their own personal experiences in healthcare or even in other industries, whether it's I went to the grocery store and I maybe had a frustrating experience with some aspect of that service. But thinking about healthcare, and healthcare can be so incredibly personal for us and for our family members, I think we all here on my team, we just felt this deep sense of connection to that, because we could all relate to either where we'd had very positive experiences in our own healthcare situations or negative experiences. And so I think the work relates for all of us on a personal level as well as where we're trying to go organizationally.
Well, let's talk about that personal level. When we're talking about emotion words or emotional words, what are we really talking about?
So we're really talking about vocabulary, and what's really fascinating and has been fascinating to us is how much this has helped start to bust our assumptions that when I use one word, I'm assuming that the word means the same thing to you. And what we started to learn before we did the study, and it was one of the reasons we did the study, as we were collecting data from our patients and our family members, and our experience questionnaire is just one method. We also do interviews, focus groups, observations, other methods. But with the questionnaire, we were actually taking the data that we were collecting and quantifying that and creating what we would call a defect metric. So if 50% of the patients in a particular care process were saying that they had a negative experience, we would consider that a 50% defect rate, and that would actually, and it still does every day, it drives our improvement work. How can we improve that experience? But what started to come out is we had a general word set that we had brought over from the work in the UK, and it seemed really obvious to us that the words meant either really negative things or really positive things. And then we started to find out that that wasn't the case. And so just a simple one word, the word surprised, was one that Lauren, as she conducted the study, found that it's situational. So surprise can mean something very positive, but it can also have a negative connotation depending on the circumstances around the word.
Let me stop for a second here, because I think we're getting into a lot of terms here. And I'd like to just maybe, and Lauren, maybe ask you, why is this important? Give us an example, maybe in a question that you ask. I think, Jennifer, you were just kind of getting us into thinking about this, but why is this really important? Because you use the word, Jennifer, lean, which many of our listeners maybe have no idea what that really means, but ways of improving the experience of the practice, continuous quality improvement. Lauren, why does this matter, the words that we use?
Well, the words are so important because they're words that patients and their families use to describe an experience. And so what we really want to make sure is that everybody's really on the same page. We want to make sure that there's not ambiguity. And, for example, if a patient is talking to their doctor and they say that they're comfortable, the patient may feel this is a really positive experience, whereas the physician hears this is a neutral experience. And the reason why I use the word comfortable is this is a word that we actually removed from the final list. This was a word that never reached 80% agreement as either being positive or neutral. So we want to get rid of these words that don't have a lot of, that have a lot of ambiguity and have different meanings. And why this is so important is because emotion words have different understandings and different meanings to different people.
Can I add that what we've also learned, and we'd actually like to see even more research on this to help all of us in healthcare, is that emotions really matter in terms of they impact outcomes, care outcomes. They impact how we're able actually to engage in our own care as patients. So think about an instance where you felt highly anxious or upset about something. Were you able to really engage in a conversation? Were you able to understand and retain instructions? So think about our patients in a highly anxious situation. And do we make assumptions that they got our patient instructions, they know what they need to do about their care, and do they leave our exam room and then forget or misinterpret? So there's actually a body of work out there around the role of emotions and the impact on clinical outcomes and or, you know, people's willingness to stay engaged with their health care. And there's also a body of work out there about the role of emotions in decision-making and that a lot of decision-making is actually based on emotions. So emotions really do matter in health care, and we're just learning how to pay more close attention to that.
And with respect to these can be words that patients are using, and us better understanding them can help nurses and doctors interpret that more clearly, but also the words that we choose as healthcare providers and understanding their potential impact or understanding from the patient side of things. Am I getting this right?
Correct.
Yes, absolutely.
And how would, give us an example maybe of some words and emotions that we really need to better understand and be careful how we utilize them or clarify when a patient uses it what they mean.
Well, one example is kind of a situational word. Sometimes the context matters so much. For instance, earlier, Jennifer mentioned the word surprise, and this was a word that we actually didn't make it to our study because it's so situational. You can say positively, oh, I was surprised I won the lottery, or negatively, oh, I was surprised my car got towed. So that's a word that everybody can relate to. But then in the healthcare setting, there's also some surprising words that just don't always make it to the list. They don't always get that 80% agreement. And this is, I can only speak for our study, but words like anxious, maybe some people think that's negative, maybe that's neutral, but we never had 80% agreement. Even words like comfortable, good, nervous, overwhelmed. These are words that we just couldn't get consensus about. They never reached that threshold, so we had to remove them from our word list that we use here at our medical center now.
And what does that mean to be removed from the word list? I get a sense like I'm feeling overwhelmed or you look overwhelmed. Should I not? It's not implying that I shouldn't reflect back what I anticipate or think the emotional state of the patient might be.
Right. No, absolutely not. We have this final word list that we use on our questionnaires, and all the other words people are free to fill in, to write in the comments, but we now have a set of words from our study that we will put on a survey, on a questionnaire for patients and their families and staff to go through.
Well,
so Laura, we actually, sometimes internally, we kind of joke about this, so somebody will say, well, I can't have that emotion, it's not on our list. And it's like, well, no, all emotion words have a place in our conversations. What we're finding is that when we do interviews with people, for example, or in focus groups, you're able to probe and drill and ask for more examples and details. And so a lot of a wider range of emotion words come out in that kind of personal storytelling.
Well, we do need to take a short break. That was helpful clarification. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about the power of words in healthcare. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about the power of words in healthcare. And Lauren and Jennifer, maybe we can dive right in into some words that you found really positive and help us understand then in the context of the experience of the patient, clinician experience. Can we really assume what these words mean? Joyful, confident, happy, successful, enthusiastic. It seemed like over 90%, well over and almost 95%, these were all really positive.
So, yes, in this case, at least in terms of the group that we studied, and we did in our study list the limitations. We'd love to see somebody take the study further, maybe replicate it, and we've actually had a couple of phone calls about that from other systems that may try to replicate this with larger or different groups. But in the case of the group that we studied, there was high agreement on these words. So we feel relatively confident that these words mean positive things. We would always encourage, if possible, to have more conversation, drill down, check our assumptions, learn more.
What did you find that was surprising? If I'm a physician and I'm using these words, what word would the word confident, I am confident, that would be, I would think, a good word.
Correct.
Although the word good, I'm not supposed to use. It didn't make your list.
It didn't make the list. And actually, what was so surprising about this study was everybody's challenged with the neutral words. We heard so many times when we were interviewing our participants, they said things like, I'm either a black and white person, or I sure put a lot of words in the positive or negative bins, but not any in the neutral. And some even ask, you know, is it okay not to have any words in the neutral bin? So I think in general, there's just a lot of ambiguity around neutral words and people aren't sure about them. And in the end, we didn't have a single word that had high agreement in the neutral category.
How about the negative words? Give us some examples of words that everyone agrees are negative.
Well, everybody agrees that sad is negative. Nobody likes to feel resentful, hopeless.
Even stressed.
Even
stressed, I would have thought could have been a neutral word, but it perceived as universally negative, stressed.
Absolutely. And there was other surprises in the study. Going through, I would think, oh, that's definitely negative, but it ended up not being negative. And I think for a lot of people, it's maybe based on their own perception. For instance, embarrassed. Embarrassed was not considered a negative word. So it was really fascinating to see how people perceive these words.
So does that mean that if we were to use a word like embarrassed, and we would ask that because it may be important to understand bringing in as a physician, and I come in there to do a well person exam on a woman, and I have, you know, a medical student with me who's a male, and I'm subjecting the person, the woman, and she feels embarrassed, but do I need to understand that and be sensitive to this? But I can't assume that there's a negative emotion attached to that.
Right, and what we would say is, well, she didn't say it was positive, so it's not good enough, right? I mean, if she just said that was neutral, we wouldn't want our patients and their families to feel neutral. So we'd say, okay, there's still room for improvement, even though all of our participants didn't say, oh, that is very negative. We'd say, well, that's still not good enough. She said embarrassed.
And does the gender matter in terms of how people interpret these emotional words? Well,
a little bit, not as much as we might think. In our study, there was only two emotion words that males and females classified differently. These words were fair and fine, and in both cases, males considered these words more positive than females.
And how about as people age? Do different generations or perhaps with different cultures, there would be variation, I would think. What did you find?
We had 67 emotion words, and 11 of these differed by more than 10%. But what's really interesting is there were two words, fine again, fine and okay, varied by more than 25% among our age ranges. And the older participants graded these more favorably.
Well, it's interesting. I remember when I, and there may be some cross-cultural differences, I remember lecturing internationally, and I would ask, how was the talk today? And they'd always say, fine. What I ultimately found out, fine could mean really positive or really negative, but it was culturally, that was the accepted response there. I wonder, Jennifer, you must be doing, the Virginia Mason must be doing some really innovative work in this field. Beyond this, how is this innovation really playing out? What are you really hoping to achieve?
Well, I think the main thing is it's really helping us check our own assumptions about, again, even the words. So the questionnaire, the experience questionnaire that we focused on creating this list for, that's just the beginning. It's not the end. So all of this data feeds into improvement work that teams are doing around a particular care process of some sort. And
give us an example. Give us an example. Like, I know in your study you talked about, you know, weighing someone. How would this happen?
So how that would happen, and I think the example in the article was from our rheumatology clinic, and they were working on the flow of patients coming into the clinic to be seen by a provider in that particular effort. And so increasingly we actually would have patients and family members or others be involved in the improvement work, whether it's a workshop, whether it's some project work that we're doing in the section. So they would work on follow-up with patients and getting their ideas and understanding better what could they do to improve that experience. They might say, it's really critical that we weigh you for the appointment because that's a critical piece of information we need, but how can we do it in a way that feels respectful and feels better to you? And so in that case, they obviously changed the location. The data suggested that it was the location of where the weighing was happening that was the challenge. So they work with patients and then would trial some new ideas about how to still get the care process done. A lot of times the steps are critical steps. It's the how behind the process that needs improving.
Well, thinking about the power of words in healthcare, just raising the issue alone will help us not just with creating better surveys and understanding patient experience from what they report to us, but also us as providers understanding our patient comments and histories, and for us to choose the right words and try to be aware of the connotation of those words as we move forward in our provider-patient relationship. So we thank you for taking time with us and for sharing these experiences and really creative ways of studying it.
Do you have maybe one?
Thank you.
And maybe if you have one final tip for our listeners of either words that they may want to consider or ask or what to do. What do you recommend to our patients and our providers?
Well, I'd like to recommend that on the provider side, we ask our patients and their care companions for their stories, and we ask more about their experiences. And for patients and family members, share your story, share your experiences. Don't be timid about doing that because it'll help your healthcare team learn how to make it a better experience for you.
That's beautiful.
And I would recommend that patients.
Yes, go ahead, Lauren.
I would recommend that patients just be as descriptive as possible. And in these situations in healthcare, really more is better than less. Go into detail with your provider. Give some stories. Give some background. Share your feelings. Share your emotions. And don't be embarrassed about it.
Well, thank you both for taking this time with us and giving us some enlightening words and
sharing your stories and sharing your stories.
That's right. We've been talking with Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips from the Virginia Mason Medical Center about the power of words in healthcare. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have an issue you would like Christy or I to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, give us our first House Call question.
I'm 64 and working two jobs. Despite being overweight, I feel good. My wife says she wants me to retire. When I look at her in her retirement, she has lots of aches and pains, and she isn't as physically active as I am. To be honest, I'm scared to retire because I fear my health will decline. What do you think?
Well, boy, that's a good question, and I don't think it's a one. I don't think we're going to get in between you and your wife on this particular one, but we might have some opinions.
We do. I think a lot of it has to do with your feelings about work. A lot of people have trouble changing their sort of identity after you've been used to your work identity and your role for so long. And that can be a real big, big transition for you. And so if you're not feeling ready or you're worried about it and you're enjoying your work, then I think it's okay to continue working. I would talk openly with your wife about your desires. But if you're ready to retire, it doesn't necessarily mean your health will decline. You might have more time to exercise.
And you did say that your weight is a little bit more than it should. So there's some room for improvement here. But I remember my father-in-law, blessed memory, he worked right up until, you know, through his 85th birthday. And his feeling was if you didn't work, you were going to lose it. And retirement was not in the vocabulary. He spent more time with his children and grandchildren. But he kept on working every day. And so I think you may know what's best here. We just want you to keep doing what you enjoy.
That's a good answer, Adam. Let's take our next house call.
I've had bad scoliosis all of my life, and I'm now turning 50. I seem to be having more back pain and shortness of breath, and I just feel more tired. Is this related to my scoliosis?
That's tough. That's tough, because scoliosis can be a difficult condition, and I think, you know, we don't frequently think about that bad scoliosis is a difficult condition that can affect many parts of your body.
It certainly can, but there are also a lot of other reasons that can make you feel more short of breath and more tired. So it may be that the back pain is related to the scoliosis or just from getting older and some arthritis kind of pain. But also that could be sometimes if you have a chronic illness or you have ongoing pain, that can make you more likely to be depressed or to have trouble sleeping or have other problems. So certainly talking about all the different facets of your health would be important to do to try to tease out which thing is related to the other.
And if it is the scoliosis, well, we do know that when the back gets kind of twisted enough on itself, it can restrict the motion of the lungs, mm-hmm. and that can cause really difficult breathing, particularly if that begins to advance. And so this is one of those conditions where you might need a team of folks to help you, including your primary care doctor, potentially someone in physical medicine and rehab, and certainly a physical therapist. And maybe even looking at your oxygen rates, because if your oxygen rates were low, I can imagine you'd get tired.
That would make you tired. Well, we wish you all the best as you're working through those issues. Thank you for your question. Erica, what's our next house call question?
I'm 63 and have had Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease over the last 6 months, had two episodes of pneumonia, and developed chronic cough. Thus far, everyone says that there's no lung damage and to simply take antibiotics. I'm concerned.
Well, thank you for sharing your concerns with us. And I guess we're always concerned when we hear someone's had two episodes of pneumonia in a relatively short period of time, it makes us, you know, look into this a little bit more. Is something going on?
And the fact that you have Charcot-Marie tooth disease does make things more complicated. For our listeners, that is a disease that is genetic, that can affect the nerves and the muscles and can affect multiple parts of the body and can make you more prone to have problems with your lungs like pneumonia and a chronic cough if your diaphragm or the parts that help you breathe aren't working as well.
Yeah, this is what we call CMT, or Charcot-Marie tooth disease. It's in this class of diseases we call a fancy term, a hereditary motor sensory neuropathy, which basically means the nerves and the muscles and don't work as well. And so people do have problems with weakness in their legs and their hands, and they may not feel things as much. Their hearing may not be as good. And it's one of the most common inherited types of disorders, so it can run in families. And the problem is it can also affect the lungs because your ability to your lung, the muscle that controls the lungs moving up and down, may not work as well. Ultimately, you could what's known as aspirate or some of your secretions may not work as well. And so that's where you might be having some problems with the coughing. So this is going to require a workup. And where would you start, Christy?
Well, I would start, hopefully, if you've had Charcot-Marie tooth disease and you've had this diagnosis, then you have a main doctor, and perhaps you would need, this is something that a team approach is important to have, but having a lung doctor or a pulmonologist who can really understand how those secretions work and how your illness affects your lungs seems like would be an important step from my perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you. Looking at what's called a pulmonary function test may be mm-hmm. really part of this to see what your reserve is. That x-ray is only part of the story. Their blood work and other workup is for a more complete story. So thank you for sharing that. Our listeners who maybe have CMT or people want to know more, we'll ask our health science librarians to post information about Charcot-Marie tooth disease on our website.
Thank you in advance, health sciences librarians. Okay, let's take our very last house call.
What exactly is sciatica? My doctor said I have it and sent me to a physical therapist. Besides being overweight and smoking, I've always been in pretty good health. Is this a chronic problem or is this something that I can get rid of?
Some people can get better. It can kind of come on and then go away a little bit to have this sciatica or sciatic pain. What this is it's usually the word that's a pain in the lower back and leg that is caused by a general compression or irritation of this nerve that runs down sort of through your buttocks and down your leg, the sciatic nerve. And that can cause pain in your back and your buttocks and your leg. It can kind of shoot down your leg. And people have a lot of pain and discomfort related to this.
It's a great Scrabble word, Christy, sciatica. 8 letters, but I tell you, it's not much fun to have because this is, we sometimes call it lumbar radiculopathy, and it sounds as kind of as bad as that term sounds because it can be really painful. And it could be to that arthritis or other problems in the back really affecting the nerves. But the good news is a lot of times this sciatica can get better. And that's where this team approach, this physical therapy, really can make a big difference. Medications can help, injections can help, massage can help. Physical therapy really helps.
And a lot of people will get better on their own as well. And then there are certain people who will get better and then they'll have sort of waxing and waning of that over time. And then some people who have that kind of a pain long term. We certainly hope that yours is short term. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We do hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health, and we want you to share your questions and your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, download our health app, follow us on Twitter or Facebook.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Lauren Russ and Jennifer Phillips. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we look forward to seeing you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.